Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the 248th episode of Awards Chatter, the Hollywood Reporter's awards podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and this is now but one of three podcasts that comprise the Hollywood Reporter's podcast network, the others being It Happened in Hollywood, on which Seth Abramovich and Chip Pope take deep dives into major pop culture moments in Hollywood history, and Behind the Screen, featuring Carolyn Giardina's conversations with the artists who worked behind the scenes on awards contenders. Be sure you're subscribed to all three today. My guest today is Steve McQueen, a British artist and filmmaker best known as the director and producer of the 2013 film 12 Years a Slave, for which he was nominated for the Best Director Oscar and became the first Black winner of the Best Picture Oscar. He also co-wrote and directed the 2008 film Hunger and the 2011 film Shame, both of which, like 12 Years a Slave, starred his close friend and collaborator Michael Fassbender. Most recently, he co-wrote and directed an elevated heist thriller called Widows, featuring an all-star ensemble cast led by Oscar winner Viola Davis. It premiered at the Toronto International Film Festival back in September, and it will open across America on Friday. Over the course of our conversation at the Four Seasons in Beverly Hills, the 49-year-old and I discussed his humble upbringing and discovery of the arts, his early work as a maker of experimental short films, and his transition into narrative feature-length filmmaking, his close relationship with Fassbender and their three films together, and what, since 12 Years a Slave's big Oscar night, has transpired both in the film industry, with two seasons of Oscar So White followed by Moonlight's big win, and in his own life, leading him to Widows, a film with a far bigger budget at $40 million and far more action sequences, all very impressive, than anything he had ever done before. But first, I was joined at the offices of The Hollywood Reporter by Matthew Heineman, the 35-year-old filmmaker best known for directing two powerful documentaries, 2015's Cartel Land, in which he went deep inside the drug war along the U.S.-Mexico border, and 2017's City of Ghosts, in which he followed citizen journalists risking their lives to report on life in war-torn Syria. His newest film, Private War, is the first narrative feature that he has directed. It stars the Oscar-nominated actress Rosamund Pike as the great American war correspondent Marie Colvin, who covered many of the major war zones of the 80s, 90s, and first decade of the 21st century. It premiered at the Toronto International Film Festival, it has accumulated rave reviews since then, and it opens in theaters across the country on Friday. Matt, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. So, having made these two tremendously powerful documentaries, what made you decide to venture into narrative filmmaking for the first time? Was it something that was always on the to-do list?
No. I think, you know, I love making docs. I'll continue to make docs. You know, I was just deeply moved by the story, and I received an early draft of the script. It spoke to me in such a profound way that I felt like I had to make this film. And obviously, you know, she's no longer with us, and, you know, so it was clear that it needed to be done in the form of a narrative.
How did you first even come to know about Marie Colvin? I think that, like her, it now kind of makes sense because, like her, you have a fearlessness about your work. And anyone who's seen either of the two documentaries that I mentioned can tell that right away because you put yourself in harm's way to tell important stories just as she did. So it makes sense that her story might connect with you. But how did it first cross your radar?
She, like I, have tried to tell stories about, you know, really complicated war zones and attempted to at least put a human face to them. So I think sort of, in a sense, we are kindred spirits in that way. You know, in my documentaries, I've been in conflict zones. I've been shot at. I've been in meth labs and torture chambers and all sorts of places I never could have ever imagined being in. And so I felt that same draw to covering these stories. But simultaneously, that's, you know, bizarre feeling of coming home to New York City and being at a party the next night. And so, it just in many different ways, I felt, you know, a huge connection to her. I never knew her personally. I obviously knew of her. But, you know, it felt like the perfect first film for me.
One theme that runs through all of the films that we've mentioned and even other things that you've done that maybe aren't as well-known or widely seen, but for instance, even the 30 for 30 short that you did for ESPN about the 1968 Olympics and the famous fist-raising incident, it seems like courage is a theme, a subject that you are really drawn to and practice. Why might that be?
I don't know. I think I like finding stories about individuals who are, you know, fighting for something and I think, or fighting against something. And I think, you know, when I made Cartel Land, I thought this was a story about freedom fighters rising up to fight against the evil cartels. Little did I know that you know, those who are fighting against evil would become evil. And in City of Ghosts, I made a story about a group of individuals rising up to expose the atrocities of ISIS. Thankfully, they didn't become evil, and that's actually a positive story. I don't know. Yeah, I guess I'm just moved by people who are up against something and, you know, risking their lives to pursue what they believe is important. And, you know, in the case of Marie Colvin, you know, she risked her life time and time again to go to the most dangerous places on earth to tell stories that people weren't telling, to give voice to the voiceless, to put a human face to these conflicts. And I think she suffered immensely as a result of that. And so for me, this film is not a biopic. This film is not a sort of cradle to grave story. It's a, in some sense, maybe a psychological thriller examining what really pushes somebody and drives somebody to go to these places. Why did she do this? And then also, you know, the effects that had on her.
So that, I think, begs the question for you, because you both have chosen to put yourselves in these kinds of situations and served important causes and helped to highlight important issues. But what is it about her and about you that would make you guys run towards something that 99 out of 100 other people would run in the other direction from? And then also, do you feel like you have in some ways paid the price for having done that in the similar way that Marie did, where it just kind of, it never lets you go, really?
I mean, I don't love talking about myself. You know, and she did this for much longer than I did, and many more dangerous places than I did. But yeah, I mean, I think there's a sense that if you're not doing it, then who else will? I think there's also, for me, you know, and I think for her, you know, it's not about the thrill. It's not about the adrenaline rush. She was filled with fear. She hated being on the front lines. She hated being shot at. It was always, you know, in pursuit of this story. You know, she's competitive. She didn't want other people to get the scoop before she did. But I think what really drove her was this attempt to tell stories that people weren't telling, to give voice to the voiceless. And I think, I don't really like this term, but, you know, bear witness to the, you know, the individuals caught in these conflicts that are so often forgotten. You know, it's so easy to look at stats or headlines or photos, and so easy to keep these conflicts at arm's length. But I think her goal really was to, if she could, in, you know, 800 words, 1500 words, get people to stop and care and think and empathize for people across the world.
Did you find that there were other films about war correspondents, or, you know, people who were in war zones who were not themselves combatants, that were well done and maybe useful as references? I mean, the only thing I can even think of that got widespread attention, and I'm sure I'm forgetting others, but you go way back to the 40s, and they were doing something about Ernie Pyle. The story of G.I. Joe was at the time a very popular, I think, Oscar-recognized movie, but I can't think of too many other examples. Were there that you consulted?
I was very lucky enough to collaborate with Robert Richardson. You know, he's one of the most accomplished DPs out there and shot everything from Platoon to Born on the 4th of July to Kill Bill, Aviator, Hugo.
Oscar winner. It's unbelievable, yeah.
Yeah, and but he actually started out shooting docs. He shot a doc in El Salvador, which caught the attention of Oliver Stone, and then they went and made Salvador. And, you know, he and I spent months sort of sending each other every film we could get our hands on and talking about them and analyzing them and looking at images of war photographers and sort of figuring out our visual aesthetic. You know, we both knew we wanted to shoot in this docu-style way, but, you know, we were very inspired by a lot of the films we saw. Battle of Algiers, you know, the most sort of thematically comparable film is Killing Fields. Yeah. Obviously, you know, Hurt Locker. I mean, there's been, you know, a series of films, you know, a film that he and I actually ironically both rate as one of our favorite films of all time is a film called War Witch that, you know, a lot of people haven't seen. It's an unbelievably beautiful film made by a Canadian filmmaker. And just the aesthetic of that was something that we both were really moved by. So yeah, I mean, we spent a lot of time researching and studying how we wanted to shoot this film in an effort to make it as visceral, as authentic as possible, and to really put you in her shoes and to make you feel what she felt, to make you feel like what it's like to be at war, to be in war, to be covering these stories.
And to that same end, you guys shot in locations where she had been and with people that she covered, right? Or that were part affected by the wars that she covered.
So we shot all the war zones, which were Sri Lanka, Iraq, Libya, Afghanistan, and Syria, all in Jordan. And, you know, one of the things that was really important to me was to work with all non-actors as the background cast. And I, over the course of a couple of months, found refugees from all the various countries that we're depicting to play those roles. And so when, for example, Rosman walks into a shelter in the besieged city of Homs, you know, the two women that she speaks to were really from Homs, were really in a shelter similar to the one we depict, and they were telling their own real stories and shedding real tears. There's a scene afterwards in a hospital where a young man brings in a young boy who ends up dying in the hospital table. And, you know, he was also from Homs. His nephew was shot by a sniper on his shoulders at a protest and bled out in front of him. And so the just insane amount of emotion that he brought into that room was just almost unbearable, really.
And I think your other scene, for people who are listening to this having already seen the movie, you know, if they end up listening afterwards, the one in which the bodies are being dug up, there was another connection there, right?
Yeah, there's a scene where Marie uncovers a mass grave in Iraq, and you know, the women there are real Iraqi women, again, reliving sort of trauma from experiences that they had there. You know, and that was really exciting for me to bring that documentary aesthetic into this, you know, narrative space and to create environments that felt as real as possible so that, you know, Bob Richardson and I, you know, we could move around these scenes in sort of a 360 way, almost as if we're shooting a verite doc. And, you know, follow Rosman as she's interviewing people and Jimmy Dornan as he's shooting photographs. And, you know, like my docs, there's, you know, I tried to create environments also where happy accidents or surprises can happen. And to me, that's, you know, what I love about making films is, you know, obviously things are in this form are scripted, but allowing for things to happen that you might not predict. And at the end of this day, these women, you know, were so moved, they started doing this prayer for the dead. And, you know, that wasn't scripted, that wasn't planned, but it was this very beautiful, poignant moment that, you know, crescendoed that scene.
And your cameras were still capturing it, and so you get a very authentic reaction from even Rosmond or others. Let's talk about Rosmond, because she is a British actress who's been around for a while, and people have maybe seen her in very different contexts. We're saying last time I saw you, it's sort of interesting, everything from a Bond girl to Gone Girl and many things in between. But I think she said she's been a guest on this podcast back in Toronto after you guys premiered. And I think it's her feeling as well as it's mine that she's never really had a part as meaty and complex as this. And I know it was very challenging and thrilling to her to get that opportunity, but you both had to really put a lot of trust in each other. For her, she's working with a first-time narrative filmmaker. For you, your first narrative film, which there's no guarantee ever that there's a second, is really going to ride on the back of whoever plays, obviously, Marie Colvin. So how did you guys come together?
She came to a screening of my last documentary, City of Ghosts, and we just got along really well, and we had breakfast the next morning, and sort of the passion and vigor with which she sort of wanted this role and I think understood this role almost felt like it was, you know, Marie Colvin going after an article. I mean, she just really understood who Marie was. And we actually wrote each other these essays of who is Marie Colvin after that breakfast that we had. And her description of her was so spot on that it's so clear that this was my Marie. And also, you know, I really wanted someone who would, you know, treat me as an equal, having never done this before. Obviously, I've made films, but I never made a narrative film. But also someone who's going to, you know, get in the trenches and get their hands dirty. And she did that in spades. And so it was really exciting to be able to go on this journey of exploration, of research with her. You know, a big part of that process was gaining the trust of her friends and colleagues, many of whom were apprehensive.
Of Marie's.
Of the real Marie's friends and colleagues, many of whom were apprehensive about the film, as I probably would have been. You know, is this some Hollywoodization of our friend? Her death was still quite raw. And so, like a journalist, you know, we were going from sort of source to source, gaining their trust, getting information, and a lot of, you know, that research helps, you know, create the different shades and fabrics of who this, you know, beautifully courageous but flawed and complex person was. And, you know, it was really exciting to have a partner. And I think, you know, a big part of the documentaries that I make are based on trust and rapport that you build over time with your subjects. And I found that's, you know, the skill is quite transferable. in working with actors, and, you know, especially with Rosman, that, you know, we really trusted each other in a way that, you know, we could both make mistakes. We could both, you know, feel free to really challenge each other and push each other, where we could improvise and surprise each other. And there's countless examples of that happening throughout the film.
So you like working with actors, or so far this specific actor. Is the plan to now continue to focus primarily or exclusively on narrative, or do you think you'll do more docs? What's next for you?
Both. You know, I feel extremely lucky to be able to tell stories, to be able to make films. I'm doing a doc series right now, and I'm reading scripts. And yeah, I think the world is so malleable right now. You know, I've tried to make my docs feel like narratives, and I tried in some sense to make this narrative feel like a doc. But I also, you know, I also believe very deeply that this world is so divided, is so fractured, and that film has the ability to, whether it's a documentary or a narrative, to bring people together, to provoke conversation, at least to get people to stop and think for a little bit. And that's what I've tried to do with this film, and I hope to, you know, continue to do.
Matt Heineman, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And now for my interview with Steve McQueen. All right, Steve, thank you so much for doing this. It's great to see you again.
Thank you for asking me.
Absolutely, and congrats again on this, your fourth feature. We'll work our way chronologically here, if that's all right. We always just begin with some basics. Where were you born and raised, and what did your folks do for a living?
I was born and raised in London, England, in 1969. My father was a builder, and my mother worked in a maternity hospital in London.
Both had immigrated to England?
Yes.
Yes. From what part of the world?
Grenada and Trinidad in the West Indies.
And how did you end up with the name Steve McQueen? I'm sure you get this probably every day, but I'm curious.
Well, my last name is McQueen, and I was born in 1969, and I imagine it was the year of bullets. My mother told me that the nurses kept on calling me Steve. And I said, Steve? Steve's name is not Steve. Steve? Said, oh, I'm Steve. Oh, yeah, Steve.
It's not a nice
name. And
ring.
That was it. That was the end of that.
So what sort of a childhood would you say you had? Was it happy? Was it difficult? I know that one thing you told my colleague Stephen Galloway recently was that you always felt you were underestimated. So I just wondered who was underestimating you and why do you think that
was? Let's start from the top. Yeah. As a child, it was fantastic.
Yeah.
It was a wonderful childhood, a fantastic childhood. And had a great time. And, you know, again, we at a certain point, we lived in the inner cities. And then my mother moved us to Ealing, which was fantastic. You know, that's when we lived in the suburbs. So we came out of the inner cities area. And then, you know, we had all these parks and stuff and places to sort of play and places to daydream. And, you know, I sort of left my, you know, my mother's house or my father's house in the morning, came back in the afternoon, in the evening, rather. And it was wonderful. So that was a great childhood. The situation, because I had dyslexia, and, you know, again, it's one of those things where at that early stage in my life, one didn't know, and people weren't, you know, depending on what kind of background you come from and what sort of, and how they pay attention to it. And I think through who I was, people just sort of to put me to one side rather than to sort of find out what it was and help in a real way. So obviously, at a certain point, I thought of myself as sort of not being bright. But then I realized at a certain point, just through myself, that I was. So it's one of those things where, you know, that was a situation of, you know, there was a lot of black children in London at a certain point. There was actually a paper going around in the 70s about the West Indian children. I think it was the late 60s, early 70s, about sort of them being sort of intellectually sort of not having the capacity as other children. This is actually quite true. Yes, it was true. And so therefore, you know, what one has to have to fight all kinds of nonsense and stereotypes. And as part of that, I suppose, being thrown on the scrap heap as such. But, you know, through your sort of, you know, journey and your endeavor, you realize what the situation is and you sort of overcome it.
Well, it seems like the area at which you excelled and certainly felt most passionate about as a kid would have been art. How did that first enter your life?
Well, art, geography, and history, those are the three things. As a child, I could always draw. And through that sort of came a lot of other things, like, you know, art and history and geography, of course, go together. So that was just that was a great way of getting into those subjects.
Were you thinking in terms of art as a potential career path, or was it purely a passion?
If anyone thinks of art as a career, then they're nuts. No, not at all. It was something that I wanted to sort of investigate and, you know, and experiment and not knowing where it would lead me to. And, you know, it was just a pure sort of curiosity.
In terms of visual arts or screen arts, I guess, I remember when I first interviewed you in 2011, tied to Shame, you were talking about the fact that there was great TV when you were growing up in England, and so that was your original kind of interest. But then I think there was a girlfriend that came along that made film more appealing to you as well?
Yeah, I mean, growing up in England and the BBC and ITV as well, there was great television. I mean, before, you know, the recent situation, which is not so great anymore. And great radio, too. And great educational programs, great documentaries. So it was very much about, and those documentaries could sometimes be sort of overly intellectual or overly sort of educational, but which was great because, you know, even if you didn't know what it exactly was about, you always held on. And that was great. And when I went to art school, I had a girlfriend who was very much into cinema. And she took me to these little repository cinemas in London where, you know, I saw all the classics on 35mm. I was obsessed. You know, I thought, you know, cinemas were about the back row and kissing and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, I would never have thought of going to the cinema on my own. It was like, oh, you're a sad person. So, I mean, it was always about with your friends and, you know. Right. But then I just got into this whole idea of cinema and seeing the world, you know, being projected in front of me. And it was just, I was hooked.
Because she was Swiss, you were saying. I think she, therefore, was open to maybe different kinds of cinema than you would have been.
She could have been from Taiwan. She could have been from Russia. She could have been from sort of Botswana. It wouldn't have mattered where she came from.
Yeah.
It's just that she had a knowledge of cinema. And that was it. It could have been anywhere.
So you mentioned going off to art school. How did your family feel about you going down that road?
Didn't really matter. I mean, again, I think they were just, you know, again, my mother was much more sort of supportive in the way of the arts, and my father was more like, get a trade. Just because, you know, working class person, you know, you want your son or your daughter to do well, and or, you know, it's like, you know, a certain kind of families want their children to be doctors and lawyers. It's like, you know, they want to be safe. That's all.
And so you started off, I believe, Chelsea College of Arts, then you go over to Goldsmiths, which is part of the University of London. What was the NYU chapter here? I know it was short. How did that factor in, NYU Tisch?
Because I wanted to go to film school. When I came out of art school, I wanted to go to film school. So I was always like film and art and film. It was always like that. I got into NYU, and it just wasn't for me, really.
Had you spent time in America before that?
Yes. The majority of my family are from the States, New York, and a lot of them in Florida now. So, yes, I've been coming to America since the blackout and Elvis died, 77, yeah.
So when you walked away...
Summer.
Yes, exactly, yes. I think Summer of Sam as well, maybe. There was some...
Possibly, yes.
Yeah. When you walked away from film school, between that moment and a moment in 1999 when, at the age of 30, you won a very prestigious prize that I'm going to ask you about in a moment, what were those years comprised of? What was going on in your life in those years in between leaving NYU and the Turner Prize?
Well, when I left for America, I had a situation where there was a chap called Richard Curtis. He was the head of film at the British Council. He said, if you ever come back, if you want some money to make something, because he assessed my university sort of degree as well as everyone else's as an overseer. And he basically took to me and he said, look, if you ever come back to the UK, look me up and I would love to sort of help you, give you some money. So that's what I did immediately after I came back.
To give you money to?
To basically to make an artwork, a film.
Yeah.
And such. And he did. He gave me £5,000. Which was a bit of money in those days, not now, of course. But I helped to make a film called Five Easy Pieces, which I made, and then that sort of got the attention of certain people as well as my graduation film, and then I got into, you know, sort of I got a gallery and I showed the two films at the ICA, the Institution of Contemporary Art in London, and things just took off from there.
And was it always art with a film component, or were there other forms of art as well, sculpture and different things?
There was three-dimensional objects, yes, as well. Mm-hmm.
And so what were the works, if somebody were to go and do a Steve McQueen art retrospective from that period, what were the ones that probably most caught the eye of, I believe it's under the auspices of London's Tate Gallery, but this Turner Prize, which is a $60,000 award for the best British artist under the age of 50, which you ended up winning at the age of 30 in 1999. Which works most impressed them?
You have to ask them that question, but I imagine, again, I mean, I think that caught people's eye was a film called Deadpan. It was basically a sort of taking a scene from Steamboat Bill Jr. From 1928, which was a Buster Keaton picture, which he took actually from the first Mickey Mouse picture called Steamboat Willie. Basically what it is an image of myself standing in front of this sort of bar house and the facade sort of collapsing and me being sort of miraculously sort of surviving this through a window, which it falls through me.
And it's 4 minutes of screen time, but I'm sure a lot of work goes into making something like that, right?
Yeah, it's an artwork. It's not a short narrative. It's an artwork. Yeah. So I sort of hate the description of short because it's not a short.
Right,
I mean,
right.
It is an artwork. And it's like, it's not about time. It's about what happens within that time.
And there were others in that vein, right? Bear, I know, is one that a lot of people talk about from 4 years even before Deadpan. Can you share a little bit about that one?
Yeah, it's myself and another participant. And we're wrestling, all kinds of things going on, you know.
And then the last that I'd ask you about is one that came a year after Deadpan, 1998, Drumroll. I guess each one of these is completely different. That's the idea. But this one is pretty inventive, what you did there with that.
Yes, I put three cameras, in fact, an oil drum, one on each axis of the oil drum and one sort of on the side of it, and tilted it on its side and rolled it around Fifth Avenue, basically.
Yeah. And so at that period of your life, how do you make money doing that sort of thing? It's obviously...
Not everything's about money.
No, so. Of course, but you have to eat.
Well, no, not everything's about money. I'm not interested in that sort of, you know, if that's the limitation put on me, then you wouldn't have things I wouldn't do. That's not my sort of aim.
No, I totally, I hear you and I respect that, but you have to eat, right?
Yeah, but how do you make money? I mean, it's kind of an odd question. I mean, maybe I'm very English and, you know, very bashful about talking about money in those terms, but that wasn't my aim. And I don't, you know, guess what? I'm here sitting. And
yes,
I'm,
no, I
and
mean,
I'm sort of, obviously, I've eaten.
Yes.
And I'm clothed, so there you go.
Okay, so... One other thing that just obviously was a turning point after those earlier works, it seems like you were not particularly interested in narrative at all in those earlier years.
I mean, it's all forms of narrative. I think, you know, again, there's a classical story and there's all kind of narrative. Everything's a narrative.
Yeah.
You know, everything you look at is a narrative. And anything, you know, even, you know, Van Gogh sort of painting Sunflower, there's narrative in there.
Right.
I mean, again, yes, it's much more sort of obviously less classical, less than Once Upon a Time in the end, but you could always find a story within an image, always.
What happened, I guess, in 2007 that led to you being able to make a feature film for the first time? Was that even something you had the desire of doing, or how did that come about?
No. I mean, of course, I went to NYU and I was interested in film, but, for me, the subject has to demand the form of it wants to be. And the subject that came into my head at that time was Bobby Sands, this hunger striker. And the form that it was asking for through sort of, you know, thinking about it was narrative, was story. So I thought, okay, well, this has to be a narrative feature film.
And the financing, though, that made it possible, that came from UK Channel 4, but was it on the basis of those earlier works that we've just talked about, or was, you know, most...
Yes, I was very fortunate to sort of have a relationship with Marion Goodman and the Marion Goodman Gallery. Yeah. And through that, those works were sold to institutions, Museum of Modern Art, for example, the Tate, and, you know, and other collections and whatnot. So that's how I sort of clothed and ate.
Yes.
And so through that, sort of having that sort of reputation, of course, people sort of were interested in what I want to do. And I met this woman called Jan Young Husband. But interestingly, Jan was not... It wasn't from Film 4. It was from the arts division of Channel 4.
Okay.
And she gave me £900,000 to make Hunger, my first feature film, and there was some money from Northern Ireland Film and a little bit from Welsh Association.
And it sounds like Bobby Sands had kind of captured your imagination since you were very young. What
Yes.
was it about him that you think did that?
Look, I thought to myself, this is the first one I make, and it could be the last one I make, so whatever. And again, you go into it very kamikaze style, whatever. What will be.
Right.
And I thought, okay, this is the film I want to make, so if I don't get a chance to make another film, this is it. And it was about, I think, that attitude of his in some ways of... using his life as a kind of a weapon in order to sort of make change. Whatever you think about that, you know there are pros and cons about how he did and what he did and why or what he did it for. But for me, I was just interested in that part of British history,
yeah.
Which was in fact swept beneath the carpet for a long period of time.
By the time Shame came along, you had reached the conclusion that you shared in that earlier interview that I had with you that I referenced, where you said, quote, "Actors are, for me, the most important thing in a movie. close quote. And you had at some point, maybe you can specify when, but attended acting workshops, not because you had any desire to be an actor, but to understand how actors work and how to work with actors. So flashing backwards now to when you were having to work with actors, I guess, mm-hmm. for the first time on Hunger, what was that casting process like and how did it lead you to one Michael Fassbender?
Well, it was a bit naive as well within the process, because I think when I met, for example, when I met Michael for the first time, I thought he was a bit cocky. I thought it was this guy. Not knowing, you know, again, that, you know, actors, you know, how much you put into to an audition, how much you leave out. You know, you've been rejected, you know, a bunch of times. And, you know, you know, again, it's very, all these things I wasn't so aware of at that, you know, at that point, yeah. which I should have been, of course. But it was through that process. And Michael came back the next day because I said no. I said, okay, well, I'll put him back and see him again. The next day I saw him. I thought, oh, the guy's got something.
Yeah.
You learn. You learn through your mistakes most of the time. But then again, I'm very, how can I say this? For me, actors, and to collaborate with them is one of the biggest joys of my life, really. Because to sort of to inspire and to be inspired is a huge thing. To sort of, you know, what I want from an actor is to sort of, you know, get them to be at a certain point, is to be a sphere where whatever they do, you know, it's like a sphere. It rolls this way, it rolls that way. It's perfect. Whatever they do is right. And my job is to hopefully help them get to that point and then get out of the bloody way and just say action and cut.
So on that first feature-length film, you told me, I believe, that it was 24-day shoot, mm-hmm. $2 million in U.S. currency budget.
Then it would have been much less.
It was less at that time.
No, because are you doing the conversion now or then? I'm talking about money now. Look, see?
Yeah, well, it's
I didn't want to talk about it before, but now I'm talking
about it. It's all part of the process. So you're saying less than $2 million. Did you enjoy that first experience making a film, or did you feel pressure? You did.
It was what I was supposed to be doing. I loved it. It was like from day one. I never had been on a movie set before in my life, before I stepped on my own, never. And that was because I didn't want to learn anyone's habits. I wanted to sort of, you know, find it myself. So the first day I was on set was the first day I was ever on a film
Amazing.
Set.
Amazing. Obviously, that was the beginning of what became a very close and running collaboration with Fassbender. Can you pinpoint what clicked with you two? Why did you hit it off?
I think we just enjoyed each other's company and we trusted each other. I think when you've got an actor who trusts you, or he or she sort of has that sort of, they feel safe, and the environment you make, I mean, I think it starts with catering. It starts with electricians. No, it really does. Yeah. It starts because, you know, actors are very sensitive people. They know when things are up. They walk into a room and they can feel the energy. And if they're in a place where they feel that it's safe, then they'll go for it. I think that's what I try to do, make that environment where they feel that they could do anything they want to do and fall on their face and get up again and try it again. Try things out. It's a safe space to experiment.
So how does that actually manifest itself? If you see something that you would like different on that an actor's doing, you, rather than speaking to them in front of everybody, you kind of go off with them privately? Or how does that work, actually?
No, I think, but if you're not doing it by that stage, you're not doing a good job.
Yeah.
No, before they get onto the set, you have to have a certain situation where they, you know, they're doing it wrong then, but you're not doing your job properly.
Hunger introduced us to something that I believe is a theme of your work, or a reflex that you have, which is to use unusually long takes. Is that a fair statement? Like, I think that each of your films has quite long takes throughout them, right?
Well, they're not there for fashion.
No, of course.
No, but I mean, you wear extraordinarily long. No. But look, it's there to sort of, it's, you know, again, you know, if there is a long take, it's there for a purpose and for a reason. You want it to be, it's not there for show. It's right. there for practical reasons.
Yeah.
In order to sort of advance the narrative. It's all about what the story wants. So if there is that, great.
It's not conscious.
Just like there was a two shot. I mean, you know, is that unusual? I don't know. Look, it's all about how it advances the narrative. It's right. very, very important. That's all I'm after. You know, maybe next film there isn't. Maybe there is. It's how it advances the story. So, right.
The rollout of that film, I wonder if you can talk about it. It was certainly a big thing for cinephiles at film festivals. It played Cannes, Telluride, Toronto, New York, and many of the other big ones. And so for people in the business or real cinephiles, I think it really put you on their map. But how about the theatrical release? Was it something that you were pleased with?
I think there was some mistakes made, especially in the United States, I'll be honest with you. I don't think they knew what they had.
Yeah.
So therefore, it wasn't promoted very well.
Right.
And then the people saw it. So what the hell? I mean, look, I'm going to be frank with you. When we were in Cannes, you know, there was a situation where certain people who were on the jury said to me, well, the reason why it wasn't in competition because they didn't want to be the second film which, you know, had an IRA theme to sort of, you know, be a possible winner. Because the year before was the winner, Shook the Barley. So, you know, there's all things going on. And it was just one of those things where, you know, you learn how things work out.
Yeah, yeah. So it would be another 3 years before we saw your next film, Shame. Did you feel a bounce out of hunger in terms of suddenly the industry was clamoring to work with you? Or how did it affect your life? Because it sounds like you just do what you feel like doing in the best sense. But did Shame come about because somebody came to you and said, we think this would be a good idea? Or was you coming?
No. Yeah. No, I had a conversation. It was myself and Abby Morgan, the co-writer of Shame. And you know, she wanted to meet me and we had a tea, which turned into a lunch, which turned into a dinner. So we basically got on like a house on fire. And we just started to talk and talk and talk and talk and talk. There was no real agenda other than the fact that she was an admirer of Hunger. And then we got onto the subject of sexual addiction.
How did that come up?
Through just being honest and talking about who we are as human beings and so forth. It was a beautiful conversation because I never met Abby before in my life. And we, you know, it happens sometimes when you strike up a friendship just like that. And that's how we started to sort of think about a film about sexual addiction.
And I know you've said it's a subject that certainly just, you know, whatever, that's 7 years ago, but even then it was less talked about. Some people didn't acknowledge that it was even real. Was part of the motivation to change that?
No, I mean, I think it's a great story.
Yeah.
I love the idea. I was just thinking, I said, this is an addiction where someone needs other people to sort of gratify that addiction. Of course, you don't only need another person, but more than often, you need another person to satisfy that addiction. I love the idea of that. And obviously, sex and cinema was kind of interesting to me, too, in some way of expressing that. And, you know, again, it's the film that sort of, it's almost like a dog whistle that went off in the cinema, because a lot of people was like, you know, they sort of saw something on the screen, which never gets really spoken about, but which is very, very, it's the elephant in the room, very, very much, very present.
Was there ever any doubt that Fassbender would be in your next movie?
We got on like a house on fire, and that was it, yeah.
Well, so he's playing the central protagonist, the sex addict who
Brandon, yes.
Yeah, who struggles to connect or communicate outside of his sexual encounters and is unable to really have sex with anyone he genuinely likes, just in case somebody hasn't seen it yet. I want to give that context. But shot in 25 days, in some ways it felt like maybe a little bit, if even now feels a little different from the other films that you've done. And I'm trying to pinpoint why. Were you welcoming of improvisation a little bit more on that one than you are in others, or not really?
All of my films are improvisation. That's how good I am, Scott.
Yeah.
No, all of them have improvisation.
Yeah.
And the things that you think are improvised are actually written. For example, this scene with Carey Mulligan with Michael on the couch, that was improvised a little bit, but basically that was following script. It was the action. It was the sort of what actually happened on the couch, which was very much improvised. Things which the other person didn't know was happening, or how that one person threw back on the other person. It's sort of, again, you know, it's whatever works.
I know that many times a filmmaker will say, I don't want to tell the audience, you know, if there's a question about what's happening on the screen, they don't want to answer it. But in your own mind, maybe with the passage of a few years, maybe you're more willing to answer this one because it's always been on my mind. Was there incest between the two of them? They're nude in front of each other in a way that siblings are not usually. They both have these serious problems of different sorts in their life. Did you, in your own mind, establish this whole backstory for them about and whether or not there had been incest?
Well, as Carey Mulligan's character says, we're not bad people. We come from a bad place.
Yeah.
And that's my answer.
That's your answer. Okay. Yeah. The NC-17 rating that film got, did you agree with that? And was it ultimately helpful or hurtful to the movie?
NC-17. I mean, I didn't even know what it was. I thought it was a rap group. I had no idea. Seriously, I had no idea what that meant. I mean, yeah. I mean, I suppose it did. I know, I didn't really care. You know, I'm just happy that it got into cinemas and that people could see it. But I didn't really, you know, the numbers or anything like that didn't really bother me. And I now know it is the second largest grossing NC-17 movie ever.
Wow.
Yeah, hurrah. I don't know.
What's the first, Midnight Cowboy or something?
No, the first is, it's Showgirls.
Oh.
Go, hurrah.
Well, that's a doubleheader for you.
Oh, my goodness. So, look, I just wanted to tell a modern contemporary story.
Yeah.
And sex is a part of that. So, you know, let the chips fall where they may. I don't want to walk into any room blindfolded, and I'm an adult, and again, this is what happens. I mean, it wasn't pornography.
No.
It was telling a story about sexual addiction. So, you know, whatever amazing. Works to numb each people out. I mean, we're human beings. And I think, you know, it's about... artists are about to push those boundaries. Artists are about telling stories. That's what it's about. Otherwise, we might as well just sort of not do anything. Why bother?
Right. Well, that one, there are certain images that I'll never forget. Just the, you know, Fassbender winding up with whatever, I don't know if you'd call it a dungeon or, you know, where that one where...
The threesome. Yeah.
Then her singing New York, New York. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a very powerful movie. But 12 Years a Slave, I believe, would not have existed, at least as a Steve McQueen film, if not for your wife?
Yes, she found the book. She said to me, why don't you look for true stories? I'm like, oh, yeah, of course. And then we both looked, and she found this book called 12 Years a Slave.
Why do you think it resonated with you and enough to want to make it your next film?
Because it had all the elements that I was thinking about. I had a loose idea on paper, and it basically matched all of them and transcended it. And I couldn't believe that I hadn't heard of Solomon Northup before. I couldn't believe I'd never heard of 12 Years a Slave before. I mean, I live in Amsterdam, and it's like, you know, you can't, you know, you think of sort of Anne Frank's diary.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's kind of, there's a similarity in a way. A person sort of trapped in one way, shape, form, or the other. And the fact that Solomon Northup wasn't a national sort of a hero in America for me was just, you know, I couldn't believe it.
In case somebody has not yet seen the film, I want to say this is the story of a black man from the North who was deceived and sold into slavery in the South in mid-19th century America, and then what happens after that. Who wrote the script for 12 Years a Slave? Is that a fair question?
Well, I think, you know, I think things happen in the process of sort of making scripts. And there's a thing called the WGA. And on the WGA, you know, John Ridley wrote that script.
We'll leave it there.
It's the WGA, you know, John Ridley wrote
the
script.
Well, the reason I ask is that all of your other films, you are credited as either A or the writer. And my sense is that you are very involved every step of the way. So I just want, does that mean that there was a Steve McQueen version of the script that existed along the way?
Look, I think, you know, the fact that I sort of came up with the idea, I found a script to get my wife, I think that says it all, really. Sure. I don't think I have to go any deeper.
Sure. Back with Fassbender again, working this time with Brad Pitt, also as a producer on a film with a bigger budget than either of the two prior. But for a lot of people, the actor who stole the show was a then virtual unknown named Lupita Nyong'o, who went on to win the Best Supporting Actress Oscar and became a movie star through that movie. Where did you discover her, and what convinced you that she was right for that part?
I just thought she was absolutely amazing. It was a long, long search for that character. And it was similar to sort of looking for Scarlett O'Hara, I suppose.
Yeah,
in a way.
Yeah.
It was a similarity to it, because it was very difficult to get that character. And all of a sudden, Francine Maisley, this amazing casting director, sort of sent me this tape. And it was actually two women she sent me tapes of. And then one of them was Lupita, and that was it. That was the you know, I showed my wife, showed my daughter, and that was it. That was the end, yeah.
Was that shoot overall, I mean, I'm thinking about what Lupita's character alone endures in that movie. It's pretty brutal and emotionally very rough. You know, the whole storyline is devastating. So I wonder, though, for you guys, is it the kind of thing while you were making it that you are able to sort of turn the emotions on and off? Like, what happens when you say cut on 12 Years a Slave?
Well, it's not that simple. I think, you know, any movie, it's not just that movie. It's not to break out the beers, and, you know, you know, you've got to be very sensitive to that, you know, to that environment, and respectful, and, you know, it's something. It's not sort of something I could actually be flippant about at all. Far from it. It's very serious. Yeah.
Can you take me back to the Galaxy Theater in Telluride, Colorado on the night of Friday, August 30th, 2013? I believe it was the first anywhere screening of 12 Years a Slave. I was lucky enough to be one of the people there, but I wonder for you, did you go in with the expectation that people would respond the way they did to it?
I didn't know what would happen. I was very excited that the fact of showing the picture, that was the first time, it was the first screening, I think. Yes, it was the first screening. I was very excited about that, and it was incredible,
yeah.
The response. It was incredible. I mean, it was just, you know, people in tears, people hugging each other who didn't know each other, the whole thing. It was the power of cinema and what cinema can actually do. And I was very sort of humbled by it, really.
After the screening ended, there was a Q&A that featured you. I think all the Plan B folks, including Brad Pitt, of course, who's also in the cast, the rest of the cast. Do you remember who the moderator was?
I didn't know. I can't remember. Apparently it was Barry Jenkins.
Yeah.
But I couldn't, you know, it was just everything's a fog. I mean, it was him, apparently.
Yeah, well, because Barry's been a volunteer at Telluride for years. And the other crazy thing is that from that Q&A came Moonlight, because the Plan B guys said to Barry, what have you been doing since your prior film years earlier? And that was, he says, the beginning of Moonlight.
Yeah.
Did you realize that?
No, but Plan B did tell me 12 Years a Slave had a huge impact on getting Moonlight and Selma made, because they wouldn't have got made otherwise.
Yeah.
Because the fact of the matter was, at that point in time, people close to me was just saying, you know, your impossible movie. And the fact of the matter is that they were saying that, you know, this film will do nothing internationally, and that, you know, it might make a little bit of money in the United States. But of course, that was all sort of turned on its head with this movie. So I think that's when Hollywood realized, okay, well, understandable. We can make money out of working with predominantly black characters.
Well, that's exactly what I wanted to ask you about next, because for many years there was this kind of axiom in Hollywood, quote, black films don't travel, close quote, meaning they don't make money internationally. First, what do you make of the idea of the term black films? And second, why did 12 Years travel to the tune of almost $188 million worldwide, more than $131 million of which came from outside the U.S.? So the idea of black films, what does that mean? Is 12 Years a Slave a black film? And then also just why did that one defy the quote-unquote rule?
I don't care what people call it, a black film. I don't mind. It doesn't bother me. I hope it's a good film. That's all. Why? I don't know. I mean, I think people just want good stories, I think. And, you know, again, I think that's the beginning and end of it, really.
Yeah. Take me through Oscar night. This was after the usual kind of circuit has its run of several months of, you know, the film being recognized in all different places and festivals and award shows. You finally get to the Dolby Theater, and I think I remember seeing you that night, and you said something like that you were very reconciled with the idea that Cuarón was going to be recognized with Best Director. In your own mind, you thought that was, I think, a done deal for that night. What did you think the chances were for Best Picture?
I had to say that, didn't I? Come on. Look, I thought there was a possibility of winning it, you know, everything. If it was director, if it was best supporting actor, lead actor, and film, and all the rest of it. So I thought there was a possibility. And that was, you know, again, it was, we won in all those categories because we made that film and it was put in cinemas and people responded to it. I mean, I only found out recently that the film was meant to have a slow release, was having a slow release, and people were going to cinemas and there was actual physical situations happening with the cinema management saying, where's 12 Years a Slave? Why isn't 12 Years a Slave out? Because the people who released this picture didn't think it would do that well themselves.
Who had also done Shame, right?
And then that's when they rushed to release it in 3 weeks. So basically, we lost a lot of revenue in that first 3 weeks. That's what happened. I've only learned this recently, that there was a lot of arguments in cinemas around the country. People are demanding 12 Years a Slave because they didn't think it would do that well. It's a slow release, and they had to rush it out in 3 weeks.
So we lost
a lot of money doing that.
But wasn't there also something, if I remember, something bizarre internationally where certain countries were putting Brad Pitt on the poster as if he was the main character in the movie? Do you remember that?
What do I say about that?
Really? I don't know, but I mean, that can't have been with your knowledge or consent.
No.
Yeah. Post 12 Years a Slave and the Oscars, you know, were you inundated with ideas of, hey, we'd like to work with you on this or that? Or what changed as a result of the film and the Oscars? Did you feel pressure or uncertainty about how to follow it up, or were you okay with that moment?
I think because I was working immediately afterwards, I didn't have a lot of time to think about that. So the HBO pilot, which didn't get made in the end. So I was just busy with things. And I had art projects and museum shows. When in doubt, go back to the art. Why are you doing it? All that noise is just, it's very nice in a way. But then again, it's just sort of, it's not what I'm used to and it's not what I'm about. So it's very easy to sort of negate that and just focus on work.
One thing that happened the year or the award season after 12 Years a Slave won Best Picture was what has come to be known as Oscars So White. And in fact, it was the two seasons after 12 Years a Slave where none of the 20 acting nominees were people of color. And while Selma was nominated for Best Picture the year after 12 Years a Slave, some were quite upset that its director, Ava DuVernay, was not nominated. Do you believe that the same organization that awarded Best Picture to 12 Years a Slave, and I believe that same year elected a board that elected a black woman as its president, in fact harbored underlying racism that kind of manifested itself through what we call Oscar So White, or was there some other explanation for how that could have happened?
I don't know.
Yeah. Did it bother you in the moment, though? I mean, obviously the optics are terrible, but it's diagnosing the root of the problem, I think, is interesting.
It's about opportunity, and I think basically it's about giving people the opportunity to tell stories. And so, you know, the whole idea of Oscar's great, fantastic, genius, all that business, but I care about people making films and telling stories.
Of course, yeah.
I think that's the main thing. This award business, yeah, great and fantastic and all, but, you know, it's about evidence, and I much more want to focus on actually getting people to make the stories that they want to make, that includes sort of Latino sort of filmmakers and directors and African-American women, the people who are not represented on the screen. It's very important. So that, you know, Oscar's great, but this is the main focus, getting people opportunities to actually make the films in the first place.
Well, and the kind of diverse cast that you've just described is epitomized by Widows, which is what I want to now come to, because this is your new forthcoming film that has been rolling out since the Toronto Film Festival. You and Gillian Flynn are both listed as screenwriters on this. It's an adaptation of Linda LaPlante's novel of the same name. How did it first cross your radar, and what appealed to you about it? It's not what many people expected to be the genre, or, you know, in many ways, just this unexpected follow-up to a Best Picture Oscar.
Well, firstly, as far as diversity is concerned in my picture, it's, you should just look out the window, look out just right here. That's the world.
Yeah.
So I'm not flexing any muscles. I'm not trying to sort of bend any rules here. I'm just sort of reflecting the people who are in our everyday. So that's one thing I want to talk about as far as that is concerned. Just want to represent the reality of the world that we live in, and that's it. The idea of Widows came about when I was 13 years old. Well, the seed of it, rather. I was 13 years old. I was watching TV. Then this series came on called Widows, and I was just sort of struck by these women and the fact that they were sort of being sort of looked upon as not being capable and being looked upon and judged on their appearance, similar to how I was being sort of judged as a 13-year-old black child in London in the 80s. And the 80s was a very sort of heavy time in London at that time, as far as race relations are concerned. And to see these women sort of circumnavigate and put on its head those stereotypes put on them and achieve their goal was amazing. It was wonderful to me to look at. And I had it, I just put it in my pocket for 35 years. It just always stayed with me.
Yeah.
And of course, today I was able to sort of remake that picture. But it's kind of bittersweet because in 35 years, not much has changed.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, you're making a movie about these four women who sort of accomplished this sort of heist in these unfortunate circumstances. And you remake it 35 years later, and it's kind of not much has changed.
Widows, in terms of its budget, and I hate to come back to money one last time, but sure, it's considerably bigger than any of the prior three, $40 million budget I read. But it's also considerably more artful, I would say, than most movies that are made at that budget. And so for that reason, I want to pose to you a question that I was actually just asking around earlier today. Does anybody have something that they are dying to know from you? Because I'd be speaking with you. And of all people, the actor Alessandro Nivola weighed in and said he wanted to ask you, what's the difference between an art film, quote unquote, and an art house film, quote unquote?
Who wanted to ask
this? Is the actor Alessandro Nivola. He's a theater and film actor. He's a very good actor, and he happened to respond to this. And I actually think it's an interesting question because those two things are not synonymous, I don't think, right? An art film and an art house film.
For me, it's about good or bad movies. That's about it. I don't really, that's your job to distinguish what's what. I don't really care. I mean, you know, I could look at sort of E.T. and I could look at sort of a Truffaut movie. It doesn't mean anything to me.
But a $40 million budget, does it for a director put any more pressure on you to make different decisions at any stage of the process?
Not for me.
No?
Not for me, no.
Viola Davis, who is so wonderful as the star of your film here, one of the stars, was surprised that you cast her as the lead because she said, quote, "If you're here to play a lead character in a movie, there's got to be a look and you've got to be pretty. You've got to sort of assimilate and have a more crossover appeal. Straight hair, a more European look. But Steve said, I want you to wear your real hair because that woman exists. She never gets introduced in the American cinema. It's time we introduced her," close quote. There aren't many heist movies with a woman at the center of them, and far fewer even with a black woman at the center of them. Was that role always, I guess obviously the title of the movie is Widows, but when it was on TV, was that character a black woman?
Well, you know it. She wasn't.
No, I didn't. I swear to God, I didn't.
No, okay. Oh, but you're so well researched. I thought you would know that. She wasn't. She was a white woman. But within the group, there was a black woman, an actress called Ava Motley, mm-hmm. who was one of the group, one of the four women. But no, the main actress was a white woman. But then again, all of my women are different to the women that were in the original Widows.
And you can't do better than Viola Davis, so that's...
Yeah, I mean, again, I think it's one of those things where she's such an amazing actress, and you just want to sort of give the film this depth, and she brings that with her.
This is the first Steve McQueen film without Michael Fassbender. Was that ever possibly going to be different?
I mean, I think it was scheduling and whatnot, so it was unfortunate, but not really. Oops, sorry, Michael. it was one of those things.
When is the film meant to take place? Is there a specific year? Or, you know, part of the reason I'm asking is, is it in Trump's America?
Oh, for sure.
For sure?
Absolutely.
And the fact that it's in Trump's America and set in Chicago... Mm-hmm. Why is it important to you to set this against the backdrop of present-day Chicago?
Well, I think it could be Trump. It could be. It's just indicative of how the world is right now, isn't it? It doesn't matter if it's Trump or if it's sort of Brexit or whatever, or sort of elsewhere in Europe. It's a time in the world where there seems to be a sort of narrowing of opinions, or a very, you know, there's division happening. And I just wanted to look at the world that we all live in, that this sort of environment we have to sort of, you know, wade our way through to sort of get to our destination, and it's not a pleasant one. You know, it's corruption, there's false profits, there's, you know, backroom dealings, and there's a trickle down effect because it affects us in our everyday. And again, it seems that politicians, you know, they should be for the people, but they're often for themselves, unfortunately.
Yeah,
and I just want to sort of put this fictional story written by Linda Plunt and place it within that our current present times.
Yeah.
So therefore, to relocate this narrative from the early 80s London into present day Chicago was looking at Chicago in a microscope, but turning it around and it being a telescope, reflecting, you know, how we live in every day, wherever we are in the world.
Right. It definitely gives us a lot to think about. It also is a full sensory experience in that from almost the very beginning, there are incredible action sequences in this film. And I don't think that I don't believe you'd ever overseen anything like that in any of these earlier films.
No.
So was there a learning curve with that, or were you into it right away? And was it fun?
I was into it right away.
Yeah.
I mean, but again, yes, but it's just that you learn so much and you have to learn very quickly and also challenge the sort of to stunt people, special effects people. It's great because, oh, can you do this? Oh, really? Oh, not thought of doing that. So there's certain things that happen in it, which I thought, okay, if it happens in that context, it looks technically twice the size it would appear to be because it's happening. Well, I don't want to give the game
away. No, but it's amazing.
That's it. So the limitations of the environment and things happening within that limitations actually make it look twice as big.
Yeah.
And the things like that. It was very interesting. And they were very intrigued. And again, it was just wonderful dialogue. And they were just amazing, amazing, amazing artists.
Yeah.
Amazing. I mean, really, and to see them be excited by things that, to try things out differently was wonderful too.
Well, and I just have to share with you, I think you've probably witnessed this yourself at screenings of this movie, but seated around me were people of all ages and backgrounds and everything. And for both action sequences where things suddenly happened and also story twists, there were probably three or four times where somebody... there's an audible like, oh shit, or you know, something. So you're definitely landing the punches. I remember that you've said in regard to earlier films that you have not made the comparison, but I'm going to make the comparison that like Hitchcock and some other filmmakers, you don't shoot that much film. It's very kind of edited in your own mind, I think, ahead of time, or you know, you're not shooting tons and tons of unnecessary film, right?
No, I don't, because again, I sort of respect the medium that so much, because in some ways, I mean, when I was a kid, young person rather, and I had this Super 8 camera in my hand, it cost so much to process. So I had to be kind of really sure what I wanted to do, or what I wanted to shoot rather. So therefore, you have to be in the ballpark. You don't have to be accurate, just in the ball. I mean, it's like golf.
Yeah.
How many swings you have on it? So, you know, as a director, for me, it's a job of sort of having an idea of what I want to do before I get out there. I'm not nailing anything to the floor because there's wiggle room, there's movement in there. But you've got to be within the vicinity. And then you can be, you know, you're hoping for that sense of movement or sense of possibility within the limitations that you've put on yourself. And that's great. Yeah. It's like what I do is write the harmony and the melody. And within the harmony and melody, you could do what the hell you wanted to do. Or I could do it, but it's got to be within the harmony and the melody.
Right. Is there anything in common thematically or otherwise that you can sort of step back and see as a thread running between all four of your feature films? Do you see anything that they all share in common?
That's not my job. That's yours.
No, but I mean,
I'm kidding. Yeah. No, but people have said, the whole idea of, they said about a person who's imprisoned in one way or the other, and they have to escape in some ways, or they have to sort of, they struggled, and it's about their journey or their path to sort of find themselves within the prison they find themselves in, metaphorically or actual physically or whatever, spiritually. I don't know. Maybe that's accurate.
Any rhyme or reason for why that might be?
I don't know. They're saying that. I'm not saying that. I'm just repeating what you guys.
No, but if let's say that's not wrong. So is there any?
Maybe it is. I don't know. I mean, I don't know is the answer to that question. I do like journey.
Mm-hmm.
I do like seeing a character sort of evolve over time. But I think that's in most pictures, isn't it? I imagine.
Sure. Okay. I'll put forward one other idea. Darkness. These are pretty dark stories. And not that there's anything wrong with that, but is there ever a, first of all, is that reflective of your outlook of the world? Or could we see, as you know, a future Steve McQueen film, a comedy, a musical or something? I mean, or do you believe that this is just sort of what your predisposition is?
I think, listen, life isn't always a box of chocolates, mm-hmm. or whatever you want to call it. You know, I tend to sort of want to deal with the difficult things, because that's you know, I want that burden. I want to sort of grapple with it. And other people want to sort of, you know, look at comedy or look at things lightly, and it's great, fantastic. I prefer to grapple with things which are difficult because they're there, and somehow, you know, I rather go the hard path and then the easy path. I don't know. And that's me. For me, that seems very sort of, it's a necessity.
Yeah.
And I haven't got the answer for it. I mean, look at Billy Wilder, look at the apartment. That's a comedy, but it's dark.
You're right.
You know, look at these. I mean, again, I just feel that I'm not, you know, it's not all doom and gloom. I'm not the only one. You could ask Scorsese the same question. Yep. I mean, I'm not comparing myself to him. I apologize, but you know, a lot of filmmakers are like that. Kieslowski, look at them. They're all very dark. But I just think there's a lot of meat on the bone.
Right. Right.
I think that's something to sort of that you want to get your teeth into.
For sure. Well, honor to have you on. Thank you for doing this. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for tuning in to Awards Chatter. We really appreciate you taking the time to do that, and would really appreciate you taking a minute more to subscribe to our podcast for free on iTunes or your podcast app, and to leave us a rating as well. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can reach me via Twitter at twitter.com/ScottFeinberg. And you can follow all of my coverage between episodes at thr.com/TheRace. Until next time, thanks for joining us.